delighted to say we've got with us today Conrad Calau of Researchers Craft, who those of you who are at our Madrid or Budapest conferences will recall from presentations he gave variously with Channel 4 and with the BBC on broadcast television related topics. Today we're going to steer into uncharted territory for many people over the age of 40, I guess, which is the wonderful world of esports. And Craft have conducted a major look at the whole esports market with a particular focus on the users and the potential users, which they unveiled in early December. So we thought it'd be great to catch them while their memory is still fresh of what they found, to talk a bit about esports. So I think it's important to kick off, as you did in your recent presentation, by defining what we mean by esports, because certainly that was one of my early learnings from your work, was I've been including things in esports that technically aren't esports. So how would you define esports, Conor?
Yeah, that's right, Richard. And well, technically is an interesting phrase, because I'm not sure there is an actual technical definition. Although we went back to the source material, looked at some academic work for our definition, and it is essentially organized competitive gaming that is watched either online or attended by an audience. Okay, so those are the three elements really: organized, competitive, and watched either online or, when it was possible, in person. What it isn't is just watching somebody else game. And I think, especially if you're not, if one isn't too close to the gaming world, gaming and esports get conflated quite easily. And clearly there's a Venn diagram and there's a bit of a blurring there in the middle, but they are two quite different things. Some esports does happen on Twitch, and it's a very important platform, but lots of what happens on Twitch is just watching other people game, and there's no competitive element to it, sort of player versus player. So we would not count that as esports. Those who have seen some esports might think of like the big arena games and those kind of things that do resemble in some ways professional traditional sport as was, and you know, in a stadium, and it looks very, you know, professional and slick and competitive, but there is also the much more grassroots esports as well, things like LAN parties where groups of friends are essentially playing each other and other people are watching them, and that does count as esports because it's organized, competitive, and people are watching it, but it's still not being done in this kind of more formalized way. So it is blurry, it's fair to say.
So what led you to conduct the research at this particular point, and what were your objectives in the project?
Well, I mean, this was a self-funded piece, so pure interest. As you alluded to in your introduction, we've done a lot of work in broadcast TV. We do a lot of work in media and technology research full stop, and that's because we're generally, as an agency, interested in people's leisure time, and a lot of that is screen time. And I mean, it's no secret, some of the work that I presented in Budapest, for example, was all about unmatched viewing and where is the unmatched viewing going. And esports is a big part of that. Gaming is a big part of that. People spending time in front of a screen, quite often the same screen on which they might be watching traditional broadcast TV or SVOD content, and doing something that's very, very different. And from doing a lot of ethnographic work around those kinds of questions around unmatched viewing and emerging audiences and those kind of things, it just, For an agency like ours, where we're really interested in culture as well as kind of entertainment and screen behavior, it was just this perfect confluence of these things and a window into a world that I must confess I knew nothing about until we started seeing it firsthand by watching other people do it. So it's not that we were unaware of it happening, but I think actually understanding the culture of it as much as the fact that it is happening, because and we'll come on to this later, but this idea of, you know, that people are doing something on this on the same screen that is actually very, very different in many ways, and the implications that has for brands, potentially for broadcasters, but I think we would probably widen that out. And I'm not sure broadcasters is the right word to use. I think it's for distribution more broadly, because I think there's a major question over whether broadcasters can ever actually truly play in this space, given their mode of delivery.
We started, in some ways, this is your classic sort of classic project funnel. Quite a lot of desk research to start out with, reading a lot, reading some excellent books, one of which is this, which I'd recommend to anybody. It's Watch Me Play by T.L. Taylor. We spoke to T.L. Taylor, who's at MIT, spoke to a number of academics, listened to what they had to say, also people who are working, for example, in the merchandising, on the merchandising side of esports, media agencies who specialize in esports, believe it or not, they do exist now. And just trying to get a 360 degree view of the industry from the inside. And that set us going with kind of understanding some of the interesting aspects of the culture and also some hypotheses to test, and almost as outsiders to this culture, to try and kick the tires on some of the hypotheses of what is, I wouldn't say it's not a nascent industry, but it's probably teenage, which is apt in some way, in that it's going through some growing pains and it's becoming a bit mainstream. And as you'll have seen in our presentation, we liken it to kind of skating or surfing, maybe back when I were a lad, about something that's going from something that was potentially countercultural to mainstream. And we found in that some really interesting hypotheses that, or assertions really, that some of those who kind of guarded the culture, almost guard the inner sanctum of the culture, were making about especially how brands can operate in this space. And we really wanted to test whether that was true. And then it kind of sort of coincided, as we were having the germs of these thoughts, it coincided with COVID, and we thought, pretty much all screen-based activity is flying through the roof at this time. Surely this must be growing as well. Is this going to be a moment? We're generally not particularly fond of moments, because clearly most changes are slower and processes, but we thought this might be a bit of a step change in terms of how the mainstream engages with esports, and that was actually proven in our research. So that kind of framed the context. So there's a significant piece of scoping before we even actually got to do anything. And then after that, it was in some ways your classic qual, though really it was digital ethnography and then quant project, to size and understand some of the phenomena that we'd seen in the digital ethnography. We went about the recruitment for the digital ethnography in a reasonably innovative way, in that we placed adverts on Facebook. We really wanted to get into the culture of esports, and we didn't think that traditional qualitative recruitment would allow us to get into that in the same way. And that was quite eye-opening, because we did get some really interesting participants who were, you know, hardcore. Mm.
Yeah, there's a great video that you've put out that we'll include in the show notes for the podcast, where you'll get to meet some of the contributors talking to camera. Because I guess a positive side effect of the methodology is that you probably recruited more garrulous outgoing people, but then that helps them get their message across.
That's right, and also because of their aptitude with technology, you know, they're sort of cyborgs, really, part internet. You know, they're so adept at using technology that the remote filming that we were doing with them, that they were brilliant at it. So it almost looks like we went in home with them sometimes, when we never visited any single one of these people because of the COVID restrictions, but they managed to shoot some fantastic film and really you know, bring to life what it's like to be a hardcore esports fan, yeah, or player in some cases.
The big framing question is, how did you estimate the size and the characteristics of the esports audience, and perhaps, as importantly, the potential audience for growth?
In terms of size, right now we say 10% of the of 16 to 5 to 55 year old have either watched or attended an esports event ever. So that's about 4 million people in the UK and 14 million people in the US. So we would say that's already a significant audience. There are stereotypes about this audience that we ourselves were probably, as you know, subconsciously just as guilty of believing. And it does skew 66% male, but you know, which is a significant skew. But looked at another way, it's a third female, right? Mm. And so it's not simply the preserve of teenage boys. Half of that group is under 35, and a further third is under 44. So, you know, we're talking around 85% being under 44. And we think that there's a good, if you look at the sort of longer sweep of history and popular culture, there's a good reason for that. I'm almost 42, and I am probably at just about in the sweet spot of when gaming became mainstream. Consoles were something that you could have in your house, and so at a relatively affordable price. And so I think you have to be into gaming to be into esports. And so that's why we see that there are a handful of older fans, probably even people who were into gaming much earlier, probably people who were building their own computers in their garages, like Steve Jobs and Wozniak and these guys. But in general, you can kind of see the demographic trend that gaming had been a thing in popular culture for you to even have a chance of being interested in esports. And that's why we think it kind of skews so much under 45. That does not mean it will continue to be a young person's game in future. Mm. I think what we're seeing is the kind of playing out of this emergence over time. In terms of the characteristics, those are the demographic characteristics. Beyond that, there's loads of interesting things to say. I suppose the first thing to say is that esports is not one thing, and there is not one audience, which is, you know, a trite thing that most people say about most things. But it's easy for us on the outside to just think, oh, look, here are some guys who sit in their basements and play games, and it's not true. There are different communities and different subcultures around different games, and they each have their own codes, their own ways of behaving. If we're to talk about the esports scene as one thing, it from a cultural perspective, it kind of melts. It's a melting pot of what we identified as four underlying cultural influences, which is in general youth culture, and allied to that, but separate to it, is internet culture. And what we mean by that is the kinds of things, the kind of behaviors and cultural expressions that you might see on something like Reddit. Mm. You know, meme culture, those kind of things. There is a gamer or geek influence, and we don't mean that word geek in any pejorative sense, but we do, you know, more in the identification of geek culture. That is definitely part of esports right now. Whether it will continue to be as it goes mainstream is a different question. And finally, the fourth influence is the East. South Korea is generally seen as the home of esports, where it first really went mainstream. But definitely Japan and South Korea sort of lead the way, and are the preeminent sources of esports culture. And you can see those codes even in Western esports culture, even though one would think an internet-based culture would be truly global. It isn't. South America, Latin America has got its own kind of culture. North America has its. And there is cross-fertilization, but they are quite different and quite specific. But all other esports cultures in the world have an Eastern influence.
So how do you think the audience is going to grow?
10% of the people of the 16 to 55s that we surveyed in our quant, in our NatRep quant surveys were existing fans. A further 40% said they were interested. Mm. So we are by no means claiming that the that 50% will all convert to become esports fans, but even if one in four of people of those people were to convert to become some sort of esport fan, you'd see a doubling in the audience. I mean, you're right, awareness is incredibly high, 79%, so four in five essentially people are aware of it. So there is a significant headroom to grow. Quite how far that growth will go, nobody really knows. But what you can see, we did ask when people first got into esports, and of the fan of that 10%, those esports fans, 26% had got into it in the last 12 months. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, and then a further third within the past 2 years. So we're talking, you know, very, very fast levels of growth, and COVID has probably only accelerated that. Professional gamers have had more time to engage with fans directly. Traditional sports franchises at the beginning, you know, were really dialing up their esports presence. Formula One, golf, you know, really going into getting into esports as well. As you know, that's on the supply side. On the demand side, fans having more time at home, and when traditional sports had been paused or in a bit of a hiatus, there's probably some displaced viewing there as well. So COVID's had an effect, and you know, growth is coming anyway.
Obviously, with that potential growth, it's going to be even more attractive to advertisers. And I know you quizzed your respondents about their attitudes to it. Are there any special considerations that marketers need to keep front of mind when addressing this group? I know that there's been a lot of talk over the last 4 or 5 years about how in-game advertising should and shouldn't be handled, that you shouldn't just assume it works like normal advertising. I'm guessing even more for esports, there's considerations that need to be made.
Yeah, and I think that's probably true of every medium in the marketing mix, right? It's just another medium that you have to understand how to use. And I think maybe sometimes because it's something we don't understand very well, we tend to, everything needs to be different, or I haven't got a clue how to use it, or anything like that. It was actually one of the hypotheses we really wanted to test, because as I mentioned, some of the people, incredibly helpful, very generous with their time, really knowledgeable people, but really so had been there from the beginning, man. They were like the hardcore fans of a band who couldn't in some ways almost couldn't bear to see it go mainstream and let the normies come in and then enjoy this thing that they had built and curated with such love and passion. And one of the things that some of these guys were telling us was that only endemic brands could play in esports and not be absolutely trashed by that meme internet culture. That is one of the four cultural influences that we discussed earlier, and we arched an eyebrow at that, because as I alluded to before, we were kind of talking about, you know, skating and, you know, how many elements of the what were once the counterculture, be it rock and roll or punk rock or skating or surfing or whatever it might be, have been, you know, in the end commercialized in some way. Why would this be so different? And we found that actually esports fans are not averse per se to commercialization. What they're essentially what they're against is bad advertising, not advertising, and that's probably true in every medium. Quite what bad advertising means in esports is potentially, it's actually not that different from what it means elsewhere. So don't be intrusive to the don't be overly intrusive to the experience, you know. Don't try and be over familiar, you know. Understand and recognize the codes of the culture.
And you see brands like, you know, KFC or Mercedes-Benz or even Kia cars performing very well in these spaces because they are sympathetic to the culture and are additive to it. And actually, work we've done for Credos, for the Advertising Association, you know, pretty serious quantitative work there, shows that young people are generally less cynical about advertising, actually. And lots of ethnographic and qualitative work we've done as well shows that you can go into some very deep cultural reasons as to why, you know, the triumph of neoliberal economics and capitalism, whatever, that young people these days have just been brought up, they don't question the fact that commercialism is part of the world. There's very little mainstream opposition to that idea. And as long as advertising contributes to the thing they love, then they're quite accepting of it.
As it becomes more and more commercialized, my tendency is always to try and drag things back to something I know. So if you take the flesh world sports market, regular sports, I mean, the two main developments over the last 30 years have been the evolution of the sports rights industry and also the major role it plays in broadcast, which you've alluded to broadcast earlier. I mean, in terms of rights, if you are the developer that has made a new game or a big hit game, to what degree at the moment are they controlling its commercial exploitation? If I'm going to a stadium and watching two teams play a game, presumably that game, have they paid the people who made the game the rights to that? Do they control it, or is it fairly Wild West at the moment?
No, it's fairly controlled, and it's getting more so. Publishers, some publishers are trying to implement almost total vertical integration. Mm. Build the game, own the competition, even the teams. Mm. You know, literally own the thing, top to bottom. Because the games are the publisher's IP, they will continue to have a very strong grip on it. And the way that I imagine it happening is that they will potentially start to not necessarily, we'll see how the vertical integration goes, but it requires a lot of different skills. And at the end of the day, these are games development companies, right? They're not necessarily in the business of putting on huge events and all this kind of stuff. Obviously they can upskill in those and bring in those capabilities, and some of the bigger ones are. Some of the bigger ones are even trying to develop games that will specifically become esports. And that is the holy grail at the moment. But I can't see a future where the big game developers ever cede the rights to their game, because it's But those are the keys to the castle, right? That's where the lucrative bit of esports is, owning the rights to the game.
If I want to set up my own Twitch channel and start playing The Last Jedi, do I have to get EA Sports permission, or can anyone?
No, anyone can do it. Like everything, it's a pyramid, right? And there's anyone can set up a LAN party. I think if you started to make significant amounts of money, EA Sports might have something to say about that.
Talking of significant amounts of money, I mean, could you see a situation where global transmission rights could be changing money for the amounts of, you know, the Premier League is getting $1 billion deals around the world? Could you see a world in which Call of Duty 10 sells its worldwide broadcast rights for $2 billion or something like that?
You've set the highest of all bars, Premier League football rights. It's but I mean, could I see? Yeah, yes, maybe not quite of that magnitude. I mean, I don't see any reason why it couldn't happen, but there's a long way to go for it to be, you know, global and also popular enough. I mean, it's pretty global, but popular enough. I think probably the bigger barrier is something inherent in where esports has come from. and it's just it's a quirk of history, right? But well, it's not really a quirk of history. It's almost hard baked into esports. And is this Watch Me Play book is an incredibly interesting and illuminating insight actually into the esports publishing and the world of Twitch actually. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the issues is that esports is of the internet. It was happening on the internet before it was happening in stadiums. And built into that are modes and methods of interaction that will be very difficult to replicate on anything that isn't IP-based distribution. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I sort of pushed back against broadcast, because I think maybe broadcasters went a bit early into esports and it was just a toe in the water. We know that Sky have done it in the UK. We know that BBC Three have done it in the UK, and you know, let's have a bit of a play and see what's happening. I think it was probably more the vibe there rather than we're trying to make a really big success of this. But I think from hearing from experts and also some of the esports players and competitors that we had in our sample, there was also just something not right about that top-down broadcast model. And I just don't know whether internet rights can be sold in the same way as sports broadcast rights. Yeah. That's not to say it can't happen. I'm sure there are many cleverer people than me who are working on making this happen. And the potential is definitely there for it to be sizable and lucrative.
Cool, that sounds like a positive note to end on. Thanks for making time to speak to us about this. I from what I gather, you may well do a sequel at some point in the next year or two, so it'd be great to catch up on you. Perhaps you may even go back to some of the original gamers and see what they've been up to.
Bye.
Cheers.